Okay, shall we return to the scene of the crime here? With respect to, again, the whole issue of accrual, when does the cause of action accrue and the time period, limited time period, begin to run? We have this odd little case of Pfeiffer. Can somebody tell us about Polly Pfeiffer? Nelson.
Plaintiff Holly Pfeiffer had to jump out of a building for a condominium when it caught fire. She sustained injuries and she sued. Some of the people she sued included who ended up being the builder, who had sold the building knowing of the defects that they had created in it with a lot of codes and violations and things like that.
Okay, so negligent things they did that resulted in her injury. Now, let's just get the time frame here. When does the fire occur and the injury sustained?
1986.
Okay,
June 2nd.
Okay, so it's June 1986. And when did the negligent acts occur, according to her?
In 1979.
Okay. And it really doesn't matter when it occurred in 1979. The question is, when did the cause of action accrue? And, you know, when is it that this, you know, first of all, what is the time period that we're looking at?
There's a statute that says 6 years for those who are involved with the building or construction of.
Okay. And the defendant says, I fit into that category. I built this place, so I'm covered by this statute. And it says, there's a 6 year statute of limitations, and when does that accrue according to the defendant?
From the time that they finished building.
Okay. So the 6 years, according to the defendant, started, and then the window closed a year before she's injured?
She doesn't have a problem with that, but she says that.
Well, yeah. Polly has a big problem with it, yeah.
She doesn't have a. Back with the way it was built, she says that the issue arises that they sold it knowing of the defects that were.
Well, when did the statute of limitations for that claim begin?
They said they sold all the units by 1979, but it doesn't say that there's a statute of limitations.
So she says this legislative declaration of when the statute of limitations begins. That doesn't apply to her claim, and in fact, the statute of limitations only begins to run after she's been injured. Which, to the extent that the statute of limitations is designed to be to give injured people a reasonable period, but it puts the burden on an injured person, go out, find the people responsible for your injury, and within a reasonable period of time, bring the claim so we can get it resolved. We don't want people dredging up stuff that's 10 years, 20 years old, and forcing everybody to constantly worry about maybe getting sued for something that happened 20 years ago. Okay, so I guess we have this thing fairly clearly laid out here, that on the one hand, the defendant says that the statute of limitations started and stopped, and it's over. She has no claim. Whereas the plaintiff says, well, that's absurd. Whatever claim I have, whatever period of time you're going to give me to file my claim, it certainly wasn't before I was injured, says the plaintiff. Now, what does the court say about this?
The court says that They look at the statute. They said that there's a three-step process to figure out if the plaintiff can hold the defendant in this, you know, liable under the statute. The first one is that the court must determine the statute scope, whether it applies at all. And so the court says it stopped right, that they have to stop right there, because the other two aren't relevant if it doesn't apply to the defendant.
Okay.
And so the court goes through and the island construction, the defendant brings up three reasons why it would apply to them, the statute.
Mm-hmm.
The first one says that it arises from the building, and that the statute bars the claim of any kind against any person involved in construction. The second is that the statute would be meaningless if the builder could not sell its product without using the protection of the statute. And number three, it says that the statute only applies to builders. Oh, it's saying that the statute would apply only to builders who do not sell their property would be unconstitutional.
Okay. So, what is the job for the court at this point? What is the thing they're trying to do here?
Figure out if the builder has immunity under the statute.
Which requires them to figure out what does the statute mean, and in turn, what did the legislature intend? When the legislature wrote this statute, they intended to do what, so far as we can tell?
Basically, that to hold builders not liable after the six-year period from the time that they built the building.
Okay, so with respect to, for example, let's suppose you had a developer who, you know, buys property and hires a construction company, Island Construction, let's say, was hired by a developer, paid a whole bunch of money, $5 million, to build this condominium complex. They finish the building of it, lay their hammers down, present it to the developer. Developer writes them a check for $5 million, and Island Construction goes home. The legislature says, with respect to Island Construction, nothing they did is subject to a suit that's filed more than 6 years after they laid their hammers down. Why? What would the legislature want to do that for?
The bad policy of 15 years later, 20 years later, interviews brought in people. And
right. This happens to be just outside the six-year period. It's 7 years. But what would prevent this same kind of claim from being brought in 1996 or 2006 or 2016. Somewhere down the line, there's an accident. It turns out when we investigate the accident, there's some sort of faulty construction, or arguably faulty construction, and now we're looking back at something that was done 30 years ago, and these folks are on the hook. No, that's not going to be, says the legislature. Now, the issue within the court is, does this apply to contractors, but only to contractors? Does it apply to contractors who also happen to be developers, who actually sell the product? Does it apply only to the construction, or does it also apply to construction and sale? And the court's answer is?
The court's answer is that building it and selling it are two separate activities. So the activity of building it will be safe under statute, but the activity of selling it, knowing of the defects, will not be.
Right. So 30 years later, apparently, you could sue the developer for selling this property knowing of its defective condition. If the legislature wants to immunize developers too, they can do that. But according to the court, the legislature only wanted to immunize hardworking, honest people who swing hammers, not those mercenaries who buy and sell property. Maybe that's what the legislature wanted. Justice Durham is not convinced. Justice Durham says, gee, you know, you read the statute, it doesn't say people who build stuff can't be sued for their building, but they can be sued for their selling. It says people who build stuff, if you bring a claim against them, you have to do it within this period of time. These people built this stuff. They are the people that this statute is talking about. I don't see where there's any daylight, says Justice Durham, to invent this new category, which is selling something rather than building it. But again, as we've seen before, the court's job is to try to figure out from something that's not as crystal clear as it might have been, what did the legislature intend? And courts tend to decide that legislatures intend something sensible rather than something which to them is not sensible, nonsensical. It would be nonsensical to the court to say that Holly Pfeiffer, in effect, waited too long because she waited until after she was injured to sue for her injury. A strange idea, the court seems to think. Although we will apply that to people who actually build stuff, we won't extend it any farther than we have to. Springfield? Pardon that? Well, this one doesn't distinguish between the type, the legal pigeonhole into which we put the claim, whether it's negligence or breach of warranty or some other legal theory. What the court is distinguishing is the act that gives rise to liability. So it is saying the act of actually hammering nails or choosing 2x4s instead of 2x6s, or plywood, or, you know, modifying the plans. If it's a construction thing that we're complaining about, that act enjoys this short window. It's the sale, fraudulent, breach of warranty, whatever you want to call it, it's the sale that they say lies outside the coverage of this statute of limitations. Again, maybe that's what the legislature wanted. Maybe it's not what the legislature wanted. The court's got to make that determination. So again, for your purposes, thinking about statutes of limitations problems, I've got to know what the limitation period is that covers my particular kind of claim, and then I've got to know when did it begin. Did it begin when the actual injury occurred? Does it begin when the plaintiff knew or should have known about the injury and its cause? Does it begin at some arbitrary place established by the legislature? Because they get to write the statutes of limitation and they can do it as they see fit. And the people in the building industry have, you know, friends in the legislature. If that's what the legislature wants, again, we try to give them what they asked for. So be it. Questions about this whole idea about, again, identifying the limitation period, then figuring out when does the clock start ticking? I might say that this shades into something we will call a statute of repose. And it comes up in the product liability area as another form of limitation, but it's a different, the concept behind a statute of repose is different from a statute of limitations. A statute of limitations is essentially how quickly did the plaintiff act on their right to sue. And again, we can have no complaint about Holly Pfeiffer. Holly Pfeiffer could, you know, mid-air, leaping off the balcony, file her claim. She could do it, you know, within a split second of her injury. It's not that she waited too long in filing her claim. According to the defendant, with respect to the contractor, her claim was no good the moment she was injured. That is the concept behind that is not you waited too long to act on your rights. It is saying there is a statute of repose which is measured from the time the defendant finished their work. And again, it applies both to contractors in this case, and in Chapter 9 we'll see it applied to product manufacturers. I sell you a punch press that stamps metal parts, and I sell it to you in the middle of World War II, and you're stamping out parts to make, you know, tanks or airplanes or jeeps or what have you, and you know, these are useful machines. They're still around in the 1960s and the 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s. And lo and behold, somebody gets hurt by one of those things. And they want to sue the manufacturer. Can a manufacturer who sold this product in the middle of the Second World War be sued in 2003 for an injury that it caused? The legislature has thought about that and creates this idea similar, as we'll see in Chapter 9, the idea of a statute of repose. There's a limited window, not how quickly the plaintiff runs down to the courthouse, but there's a limited window for a defendant's conduct that after a certain amount of time elapses, we say, the defendant's no longer responsible for this. So again, we'll return to that in Chapter 9. Okay, the final part of Chapter 7 has to do, as I said before, with the idea that even though the clock has started to tick, we would say, wait a minute, the clock needs to be stopped, time out here, while something else is going on, or while it would be unfair to let the clock run. And our first example of this is Walters. Can somebody tell us about Mrs. Walters and her stay at the hospital? Ms. McGrain.
Virginia Walters was admitted to the hospital and she stayed there for a while. And then, like 2 years later, she realized that while she was there, she was injured. And she realized it was because the nurse failed to do something. And then she brought a claim.
Okay, so let's get the dates here. When is she in the hospital?
June 1st.
Okay.
It was when the accident happened.
Okay.
And then she was discharged on July 3rd.
Okay, so she's injured. Then she's discharged. Okay, we're working with a 2-year statute here. So the question is, what did she know and when did she know it? It may be that at the time she was injured, she knew that this was a result of the negligence of the defendant, but she says that the clock doesn't start running until after she's discharged from the hospital. Why? Well, you know, we may shrink from the consequences, but we're asking the legal principle here. When should we start this clock ticking? Let's suppose she was in the hospital for 2.5 years. Well, but the continuous care and treatment doesn't apply to this case. Why doesn't the continuous care and treatment principle apply to this case? Let's think of a hypothetical in which it would apply to this case. Yes, let's suppose they were giving her the wrong drug, or they were failing to treat some condition that she had, and they kept failing to treat this for 2.5 years, and then she's discharged. The fact that the negligence began at one point, as long as the negligence is part of a continuous negligent act, continuous care and treatment, but the negligence in this case is not caught up in her care and treatment. It wasn't that they gave her the wrong drug or didn't give her the whatever. The problem is they dropped her out of the bed or, you know, didn't help her. Some slip and fall, basically, that happened to her in the hospital. Okay. Nonetheless, even though continuous care and treatment wouldn't apply, she argues that, let's take the hypothetical that she's in the hospital for 2.5 years. And she would argue the statute of limitations wouldn't run so long as I'm under the care and treatment of the defendant. Even if the thing I'm complaining about wasn't the treatment that I received, but something else that happened to me. Why would we, at least, why could she make an argument that we ought not to allow the statute of limitations to run on a claim while she's under the defendant's care and treatment? Well, that she physically can't do it. So, suppose she has, you know, suppose her lawyer's coming to her and talking to her about, you know, her stock portfolio or a real estate deal that she's involved in. And she could, you know, the lawyer could bring her the forms and she could sign them and the lawyer could take them down. Ms. Reed. Okay. Now, people do occasionally engage in litigation with people that they have relationships with. That is, employees can sue their employer. You can have, you know, things where, yeah, we're still in this, but I still have this lawsuit going over some. But it does certainly affect the relationship. In fact, you can make the argument that while it's not so much that she's literally afraid they're going to, you know, inject her with cyanide or strychnine or something, but you could argue that while she's in this dependent relationship, it's unrealistic to expect her to even perceive things correctly. You may know about something, a phenomenon called the Stockholm Syndrome. It's taken from, it's actually come into common parlance in domestic violence situations where law enforcement or social service agencies are puzzled by a battered spouse or in some other relationship where you say to yourself, why don't you essentially see this this brutal person for who he or she is? And they use this phrase, the Stockholm Syndrome, because there was a well-known case, I think it occurred in the late 70s or 80s, a bunch of bank, it was in Stockholm, and these robbers came in to rob the bank, something went wrong with the robbery, and so they wound up taking the bank employees hostage. And the I think the captivity lasted maybe 3 or 4 days, something like that. And they're negotiating. The police are negotiating with the robbers and so forth. In the meantime, that, you know, it's a little bit like Dog Day Afternoon, if you've seen that movie with Al Pacino, and it's a good movie. But hostage situation. The robbers are negotiating with the authorities, and so they finally figure out some way to either rescue them or liberate them, or somehow the hostage ends. And to their astonishment, the bank employees have bonded with the robbers and are sort of, you know, they're mad at the police because the police wouldn't give the robbers what they wanted. And the police are just stunned, and everybody else is stunned. What happened here? The same Patty Hearst scenario. Patty Hearst gets kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army, and pretty soon, you know, she's toting the automatic weapon at the Hibernia Bank, and she must be doing this under compulsion. No, lo and behold, Patty Hearst styled herself you know, a revolutionary. And now, you know, later on she realized, what was I thinking? But at the time, again, the Stockholm Syndrome notion that we don't always perceive things correctly because we identify with the person that has power over us. We don't preserve our perceptions free of what we sort of come. We want. We don't like the cognitive dissonance of believing that the person who has power over us is bad. That's a tough place to be. So we gradually change our perception of what's good and bad to conform to the realities of the situation we're under. Some of you, well, before this midterm exam, some of you may have thought I was actually a nice guy. And that's because your perception has been warped by the power that I have over you. And remember this phenomenon of the Stockholm Syndrome that you want so desperately not to be in a situation where the person who has power over you is a bad person that you'll start sort of making up stuff. So the argument with respect to Mrs. Walters is, as long as a person is in the care and control, it's not just that it will be difficult for them, that they can't find a lawyer, or that they'll be afraid that somebody's going to feed them strychnine. They don't even see the ways in which they're being hurt and exploited because it's too hard to think that way. And therefore, you could, actually this principle of continuous care, or not continuous care and treatment, but this principle that the plaintiff wants in this case is actually applied to clients of lawyers. The rule in Washington, for example, is that the statute of limitations doesn't begin to run on a legal malpractice claim until the relationship between lawyer and client is finished. If you want the statute of limitations to start running with respect to your client, you can't keep them as a client. As long as they're your client, you can't expect them to bite the hand that feeds you. Not because they're afraid you're going to do something wrong to them, even if you could establish, it's a very sophisticated client. The point is that the power relationship is such that wouldn't be fair, in effect, to allow the defendant, exercising this power over the defendant, to say, oh, at the same time, the plaintiff's supposed to recognize that they have a claim and go pursue it. Now, in this case, obviously, there came a point at which she left the hospital. And there's no reason in this period of time that she shouldn't have gotten her act together and filed a claim. But you could imagine a case in which this care and treatment extended. Imagine a person who's in a long-term nursing home, psychiatric facility, some other drug treatment or what have you, where they're in for a long period of time. And, one floor over the cuckoo's nest or whatever, in which a person is told, in effect, you have to file this claim within that period of time. And the plaintiff would say, huh? Now, again, the court could have found this to be a provision where the statute of limitations was told during this period, but they say, no, that principle only applies where there's, in effect, continuous negligence. If the negligence didn't relate to the care and treatment, then the statute of limitations doesn't get told or claims barred. So, again, the idea of tolling the statute of limitations is some equitable reason why it wouldn't really be fair to allow the defendant to take advantage of the statute of limitations. The plaintiff is under some disability, or the defendant has put the plaintiff under some disability to make the statute of limitations inapplicable. Okay, let's look at the final case here in Chapter 7, Strawler. Here the disability, or the reason for tolling the statute of limitations, is age, minority, infancy. Common provision of statutes of limitation that they're not applied to children below the, to children. Somebody tell us about Strawler? Ms. Russell, what would we do without you? Okay, go ahead. Okay, so why doesn't, or let's see, the original notion would be the statute of limitations would run, but she argues that the statute of limitations doesn't run because... actually, before we even get to the statute, we sort of keep going back and forth here. The first thing is, you've got an ordinary statute of limitations, but we have another principle that says the statute of limitations is tolled. We form a timeout, in effect, even if the plaintiff's well aware it's not a discovery rule issue, but we say the statute of limitations is tolled during minority, during the time that a child is not yet of legal age. Why? What's the idea behind that? Why do we toll the statute of limitations for a child? No, in general. Is it general? Yes, they don't have the legal right. Sort of like the idea of poor Mrs. Walters sitting in her hospital, or lying in her hospital bed, she can't get out of bed and go down to the courthouse and file a lawsuit. Well, a kid doesn't have the legal power on his or her own. A 10-year-old can't walk down, pay the filing fee, and sue somebody. A 10-year-old needs someone acting on their behalf. So the idea is that until the child reaches legal age, in effect, they suffer from this sort of legal incapacity. And until they're of legal age, we can hardly expect them to exercise their legal rights. Now that principle, in turn, gets affected by this statute. What does the statute say? Okay. But there's another principle operating through the statute. What did the statute do to change the tolling provision? Griffin? Okay. It essentially imputes to the parent, or imputes to the child, the knowledge of the parents. It says, in effect, although we generally hold children... we told these cases where the child has an adult or a friend who could bring this suit, we're going to start the clock ticking and essentially tell the parents or the best friend, if you care about this kid, get down to the courthouse and file a claim because the clock is ticking on that claim. So by statute, the court has modified that rule to force children, or the representatives of children acting on their behalf, to go file a claim. And the defendant says, according to that principle, the statute of limitations started and the statute of limitations has run and your claim is barred. Now we get to the plaintiff's response to that, which says, you know, statute, why doesn't the statute control? You already said it. I just want you to repeat it. Yeah. that the legislature can't do this to, well, they can't do this to children. In effect, they can't do it to anybody. Why can't they do it? What's unconstitutional about this? Okay, and where is that found in the Constitution? Yes, it turns out, you know, we spend most of our time, when somebody says, oh, that's unconstitutional, we immediately assume they're talking about the federal Constitution. And obviously, you know, all sorts of rights are determined, U.S. Supreme Court determines things that the U.S. Constitution permits or forbids. But in addition, with respect to state legislation, we have state constitutions, and state constitutions tend to sort of parallel the federal constitution, but oftentimes they have little features of them that are broader or provide greater protection for individual liberties than the federal constitution. This is an example where it says, in effect, the legislature is bound by the state constitution. The state constitution says what? Okay, so they read that to mean that the statute in this case, in effect, excludes the plaintiff from the courthouse, and therefore to apply it in that way would be unconstitutional. There's a dissenting opinion to this. A quick one. Which essentially says, you're making policy, folks, that the logic of saying, well, you know, anytime you expand or contract tort remedies, you're making it harder for people to sue. Well, any statute of limitation is going to prevent people from getting to the courthouse. And this may be a stupid law, but you can hardly call it unconstitutional, would essentially be the dissenting judge's view. So again, we see this way in which tort reform brought by the defendant's lobby, you know, the doctors, the healthcare practitioners, the insurance companies, just like the Micra case back in Chapter 3, people concerned about rising, you know, malpractice exposure say it's ridiculous that an act of malpractice committed, allegedly committed when this patient was 12, the statute of limitations doesn't even start running for another 6 years. So I got to keep all my medical records. I got to, you know, 9 years later, suddenly I got to go back and find the nurses who were working when this happened and dredge all this stuff up. Ain't fair. Make the statute of limitations start when this in a timely fashion, just like everything else. Similar provision, by the way, was passed in Washington. We'll see it in the Washington Medical Malpractice Statute in Chapter 10. Interestingly, the Supreme Court also overrode that, not on constitutional grounds, but they failed to find an intent to override the traditional tolling provisions. A result I thought was completely bizarre, but there are lots of things I think are bizarre and people think are quite normal. So, in any event, let's bring any questions you have about Chapter 7 tomorrow, but otherwise we'll pick up with Part 3, Chapter 8. So.
Into your palm, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, I can't.